Hello and welcome to the Reason Podcast. This is where you start your week with an intelligence briefing of sorts with Reason editors Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. I'm Matt Welch. Please do subscribe to the Reason Podcast over at iTunes. Rate and review us there. Today we're going to be talking about legal weed in California, recreationally legal weed. It's happening in the nation's largest state. We'll also be talking hopefully a little bit about our relationships with various nuclear aspirants over in Asia and some Trump deregulation. But first up, the biggest news around the globe over this past New Year's Eve weekend has been the protests in Iran, which have been going on for the last 3 or 4 days. 21 people at least have been killed, 450 arrested. This is the biggest kind of anti-regime activity we've seen there since the Green Revolution of 2009. And Nick, maybe just kind of on a meta level, I want to start with you in that to the extent that I was looking at Twitter over the weekend, and I've set up my Twitter as a news feed, as to be something, I follow a bunch of journalists and all this kind of stuff. It was absolutely dreary to see that people were kind of filtering the news there, which is very interesting and potentially momentous, by spending all of it kind of policing the tone of the coverage on all of the media broadcasts and whether Donald Trump or Barack Obama had the perfectly calibrated response. What is it about us, Nick? Are we hopeless now? We cannot actually react to news on news sakes alone?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, Matt, and I was noting that as well. And it's appalling. But this is, I think every country does foreign policy as domestic policy. And, you know, there one of the things that was the tone police were out about was a variety of people, including some from the Obama administration, like John Kerry, and some from just, you know, actual foreign policy people who are not affiliated with either party, saying, you know what, this is fundamentally about Iran and it's for Iranians and whatnot. And people were like, oh, yeah, that's what Obama did last time, you know, in 2009. And look where it got us. You know, they just stood by while the slaughter was going on or whatever. And it's like, you know, the fact is that what we're seeing, the first mass protests were in 1999. The 2009 protests were a commemoration of those. We're seeing it again. And I think there's something to be said here that, you know, American foreign policy, both under Obama and to some limited degree under Trump, is working to get out of the way of letting Iranians have a revolution against a government that everybody fucking hates there. And that's really important. And it's not simply important because it will free the Iranians, but will also, assuming this happens, it will break the back of kind of Islamic fundamentalism, because the Islamic Republic was the first truly ideologically theocratic state in the Middle East, as well as in Islam generally, in a very, very big and profound way. So I think it's fantastic that it's happening. I don't know exactly what America does. I do think that lifting the sanctions helped. Everybody is talking about how, you know, when Iran got money, it didn't actually flow that directly or that quickly to people. They have a crap economy. And they have a crap economy because of their political leadership and their theological, you know, the theocrats. So I think it's all to the good. And I agree with you. It's appalling that people here are talking about whether or not, you know, Obama or Trump deserve credit for a bunch of people who are putting their lives on the line to shout down a government that is one of the most ruthless and horrible on the planet.
Sticking with the sanctions, which is actually something that we do as a country that has direct tangible effect more than the utterances of whoever is holding court down at 1600 Pennsylvania. Peter, I understand that you understand computers. I've been following the Twitter feed during this process of Edward Snowden, who's making the point that existing sanctions against Iran, not broad economic sanctions, but more narrow technological sanctions, is potentially contributing to a shortage or an outage of the internet among protesters there, as Google tries to kind of block or narrow access to the cloud. And you can see I'm already kind of stuttering because I'm discussing things that don't make sense to me. Can you talk us through a little bit the possibilities of how sanctions affect the technology of dissent and protest?
So one thing that's going on here is that the Iranian government is blocking access to a number of social media to a number of social media platforms. And they say they're doing this to maintain peace is their reasoning. And, you know, but this is pretty typical authoritarian response to protests, right? It's let's take away the means of communication so that these people can't talk to each other. But then the other part of this is that Google is restricting access to some of its services. And the reason is because of U.S. sanctions. So we did lift some sanctions as a result of the Iran deal under President Obama, but that was mostly financial, energy, and transportation sanctions. And so there's still just sort of all of these other kind of pre-existing, this complex web of sanctions that basically mean that companies like Google, that some other companies are hesitant to allow people to access some of their services. And that's something that is a result in some ways of U.S. policy and of the kind of international decisions, agreements that get made here. I mean, the other part of this, though, is that no matter what governments end up doing in terms of restricting technology, there are almost always some ways around it. And I think we are seeing that continue with these protests in Iran, that there are still people who are finding ways to get access and to communicate with each other, and that it might be more difficult and that there might be barriers in place. But the sort of the downside of the internet is that the governments do attempt to control and put blockades, you know, into place. But there are always, the upside is that there are always ways around, and there are always sort of there are options for people who are determined to take them.
Catherine, another U.S. policy that may have some direct material effect on the proceedings over there is the travel ban. Iran is one of the seven countries that are impacted by the now at least kind of allowed travel ban, although it's still being adjudicated to some degree in the court system. Putting on your utilitarian hat for a moment, I know it's going to make you
feel always wear my utilitarian hat. It's my full-time hat.
Do you?
I do.
All right. All right. So you got your full-time ute hat on.
Nope. Nope. Not calling it that.
How do things like travel bans or the limiting of the ability of people to escape from awful country X into beautiful country Y, how does that affect protests in your view? Is it a smart thing? The pro sanctions people or the pro kind of travel ban people will say, see, they should just stay there in their country and foment revolution and dissent, and that's the best way to
I
go
think
about it. What
restricting options raises the stakes for everyone who wants actual death to America. There are now more people who have no option but to say death to America because they can't come here. And in general, I always find it a little bit odd that I guess I don't find it odd. I find it totally understandable that many regimes would claim to want to oppose travel in and out of their in and out of their territory when there is unrest, while actually letting a certain amount of dissenters bleed off. We saw this with the Soviet Union, of course. You know, there needs to be an illusion of control while there is actually a practice of a pressure valve. I think that is still happening to some extent in Iran and was happening until the travel ban went more fully into effect. I think it's going to make things worse. I think, you know, taking away people's options to get out of bad situations magnifies those bad situations.
Nick, I see some people who are on the kind of anti-war, either left or the anti-war libertarian side, react to, you know, the Bill Kristols of the world or anybody else who's sort of celebrating the protests in Iran, saying things like, you know, that you people complain about Vladimir Putin interfering in our elections. And now look at you. You know, what lessons have you learned? What say you? So what do say you, Nick Gillespie, when we celebrate unrest in other countries or dissent against tyrannic regimes Are we just being libertarian neocons?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I think the main thing to keep in mind, pulling off of something that you were talking about as well as Catherine, you know, we should have more freedom across our borders. We should welcome people, especially from countries where we're either applying pressure or we have people who are trying to turn their country into good versions of America. You know, there's something screwed up when we, you know, our foreign policy creates refugee situations and then we refuse to take them in. And the second thing is that none of this means that the United States should be involved militarily, certainly not in Iran. We shouldn't have been in Iraq the way that we were. And we shouldn't still be in Afghanistan. But, you know, let's look at what's going on here. And, you know, revolutions in the end, the revolutions that both, you know, stick and take place, and the counter revolutions that take those down, they're inevitably homegrown. You know, the Soviet Union took down a government in Afghanistan and then spent years, you know, trying to prop it up before that collapsed, too. We propped up a bad government, a government that was wholly indifferent and hostile to human rights in Iran from the 50s until the late 70s. It was overthrown, and it was overthrown by a native group of people from Iran who thought, you know, who had a lot of popular backing. It is now being overthrown by another, you know, group of people, a different generation. And I think it's good. We should celebrate it. We should help in whatever way we can. I don't think that makes, you know, anybody who wants to call a libertarian a neocon because they celebrate the incipient freedom of other people, you know, you're just trolling of the worst sort.
Suderman, there's a great game in the risk board in the sky in Steve Bannon's brain, and Catherine knows exactly what I'm talking about there. He sees the broad middle.
Maybe Catherine should answer this question.
No, nope.
Or Steve Bannon.
He doesn't have enough shirts on. I had a dream about Steve Bannon's shirts recently, by the way. But we're just going to table that.
He really set up the untuck it craze, I think. You know, he really should be getting a royalty on all of the untuck it
shirts.
Look,
you don't want to wear a shirt that's untucked and looks like you're really wearing a smock.
That's a good point.
You're pro untuck it. Is that what we're hearing?
I'm just
here?
Saying that we, as libertarians, should celebrate unique market niches being filled.
In that case, then the Bannon's a trailblazer. There's not many people rocking three button downs at the same time.
Yeah. None of which fit. Yeah.
It's impossible to fit on that body. But
I guess one's a napkin for the entree, for the main course, and then the appetizer and the dessert.
People literally are dying everywhere. Go back to your question.
People literally are dying everywhere, including in Yemen, Peter Suderman, as you well know. But Steve Bannon sees this kind of great game with a geographical or regional, I should say, war between kind of the forces of Saudi Arabia on one side and Iran on the other side, and that these wars are going to be fought by those people locally as opposed to U.S. soldiers. I saw Bannon speak 2-3 weeks back, and he was very insistent in a group full of generally kind of half neocons of like, hey, no more stupid U.S. wars out there. We're going to let those people fight it amongst themselves. Given that as kind of a backdrop, that there's this feeling like, hey, they're going to duke it out over there, and we're going to go on the side that basically is against Iran. Given that stated sort of a goal, at least by some forces within the administration, does that give you a sense of the willies of seeing all these things happen? Do you, in your paranoid mind, do you think that the U.S. is kind of egging this on and infiltrating these protests?
So we should avoid stupid wars in the Middle East, but the supervillain scheme to make things all sort of work out without you having to lift a finger internationally, it never works. Like, we all remember Domino Theory. Probably you, Matt, better than I, because you were alive.
I think he personally is a domino.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like, and like Steve Bannon is a kind of we talk about him and we treat him a little bit like a supervillain, right? And in some ways, he kind of this styles himself that way, right? That's his, the multiple shirts are his supervillain costume.
It's an exoskeleton.
That's, That's his supervillain signature, right?
How many, though? Can you imagine how like the proportions of that phone booth to get those shirts off to get to the costume?
This is why we don't have phone booths anymore. He's got a cell phone. He just takes it off in the middle of the Broadway
Walmart parking lot. My other question here is, I think this would be an occasion for a TARDIS reference, but I don't know Doctor Who. So anyway, carry on.
The plan, that sort of scheming where you're like, well, we can just move this one little international lever and we can say this is our strategy. And we've got like a 16 dimensional chess, like 7-part flow chart that explains how it's all going to work out in our favor. That never works. And it never works because people and cultures are more complicated than anyone can understand. And this is, I think, maybe sort of question slash concern about the coverage and about the U.S., both the sort of U.S. public and the U.S. government's response to what's going on in Iran, is that we're not there and we don't really have a great understanding of what all of the specific issues are and what the sort of rallying points and the kind of the nuances and dynamics of these protests on the ground. And if you look at international coverage of any time there is a protest movement in the United States, whether it's something like the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street, or whether it's the white nationalists marching in Virginia, whatever it is, international coverage, even when it's basically right, say British coverage, it often just seems kind of off in some way. Like you sort of realize that they don't live here and they don't get it.
We don't
live in Iran,
right?
That's true as well. But the closer you are and the more involved you are, the more you have a kind of a nuanced sense of actually what's going on the ground. I mean, just sort of as a reasony side note, Jesse Walker often writes about how people don't understand the weird particulars of subgroups and fringe groups and like what it is that they actually believe and their internal arguments with themselves and that sort of thing. And so whenever we're looking at the Iran protests, I think it's just really worthwhile to keep in mind that our information sources are like 10 layers removed, and they're all people like at best who are reasonably good Western reporters who are based there or who have been based there. But I'm reading the New York Times coverage of this. New York Times with one of the biggest international reporting budgets in the world, and a lot of their reporting is just quoting stuff on state TV. And so that's how far we are. And like, is state TV telling us total lies, partial truths, useful truths that are, you know, I mean, what can we believe, you know? And so this is, anyway, just a thing that is worth keeping in mind and thinking about. Anytime you hear anything about these protests, and anytime you hear anybody scheming to use them one way or another, or to interpret them in a way that is convenient and easy for whatever it is that they're interested in.
I agree with you, Peter, and I'm reminded of Walter Lippmann, the legendary columnist, newspaper man who ended up working in the Wilson administration to help settle the armistice after World War I. He was famous for saying, we don't, in his more isolationist days, of saying, we don't even know what's going on in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. How are we supposed to know what's going on in Europe? And then helped write one of the dumbest, post-war plans that helped directly contribute to World War II. We're still in the grip of a superpower mentality where what's happening in Iran has to have something fundamentally to do with the United States, first and foremost, probably China, probably Russia, probably this and that. And the fact of the matter is if you start to look at these things as actually homegrown, this was one of the big mistakes of Vietnam, is that we were seeing it understandably, perhaps, but completely mistakenly through the lens of superpower Cold War politics, when it was actually much more of a civil war. And what you're seeing in Iran now is the same thing. And when the Islamists overthrew the Shah, they talked about America as the great Satan, and we had backed a bum. But it was like fundamentally it was about Iran. And, in a weird way, and Matt, I don't know if it's worth talking more about this, but one of the weird things that might be the case is that by destroying the Saddam Hussein government, you know, and we did it as stupidly and I think immorally and unethically and probably illegally as possible, we also took out the major regional opponent of Iran, which does allow, you know, internal Iranians who, you know, when the U.S. suddenly is occupying the country next to you that you've had, a 10-year border war with, et cetera. But when we take that government out and everybody knows Iraq is not going to be expanding into Iran anytime soon, it does allow internal dissent to really start to foment. When you take away certain, props that the regime can say, oh, well, you know, we're being boycotted, we're being embargoed, that's why your lives suck so bad. Those have been taken away. And now, you know, hopefully what we're seeing is that that regime, the Islamist regime, the theocratic regime, has to answer for its actual way that it's governing. And it can't. And the people are taking it over and they're pushing back on it. And then the real question for the United States is, how do we aid that without screwing it up? Because the worst thing that can happen now is the idea that, a homegrown Iranian revolt is actually somehow a ploy by Israel and the United States and Western powers to take over. That's what the regime is going to be saying.
There's also another reason that we are struggling to intelligently cover the protests on their own merits. And that's because the protests themselves are different in different cities. And this is like a super annoying Insta expert take, but I think it's real that apparently these protests started out as sort of quasi-sanctioned anti-reformist protests and then turned into lots of different regional protests because in this line that I particularly love in New York Magazine's coverage, protests don't always go as planned in Iran. And it's like, yeah, no shit, New York Magazine. But I think, you know, this is like in some ways what we're seeing here is like, remember when the Free Mumia people used to just show up at every single protest, or like how the Women's March was also the Black Lives Matter March? Like, it's not even, you know, I think it's sort of forgivable to be a little bit hesitant to talk about these protests on their own merits because we can barely understand what's happening on the Lower East Side, the complexities of what that crowd is doing and why they are there right now, definitely beyond us. How that reverberates to other nations in the region and who, if anyone, we can like provide more poster board and Sharpies to, definitely well beyond us.
That's what we should be arming the protesters with. That's probably a good use of the
CIA. The Sharpie is mightier than the...
There's an entire subgenre of conspiracy theory / journalism that is still trying to figure out who is the Japanese businessman who in November 1989 gave a bunch of Czechoslovak dissidents fax machines.
Satoshi Nakamoto.
It was Satoshi Nakamoto.
It totally was.
So you know what all of this reminds me of a little bit, and Matt and Catherine, you will perhaps appreciate this or maybe really hate me for this, is that it reminds me of Ian M. Banks's culture books. And Ian M. Banks's culture books take place in a sort of a space future that's totally disconnected from our contemporary, from our reality. It's a post-singularity, like they've solved the resource allocation problem, and they exist. The culture is a society that exists. It's a totally anarchist society. No government. You can do whatever you want. There's unlimited resources. And they're also very, very peaceful. Like they have like an extremely high sort of like their highest value is individual choice and peace. Right. But the one part of government that they have is this thing that's weirdly sort of unorganized called special circumstances, of course, right? It's basically MI6 or maybe the CIA, and it exists to go out into the lesser cultures, the ones where they find a planet with a king who is abusive and murderous, and they'll go and like assassinate this guy. Except it always turns out that the assassination just puts in like a leader who's even worse, or they end up setting up a business deal with with an arrangement with the guy who's with some of the dissidents, whatever. Right. The point, but a sort of huge subcurrent of argument in those books is that the interventions never work. and that you never really understand another culture, and that that culture may have serious kind of moral flaws, especially from a sort of like a Western individual choice sensibility. But at the same time, like attempting to go in there and fix it is almost always a mistake, or at the very least won't work out the way that you think it's going.
You know, it always worked on Star Trek. I don't know what you're talking about, Peter.
To knit together kind of what all three of you were saying, just like in terms of the domino theory being wrong in almost every case, the exceptions to the domino theory being wrong are kind of the reverse of the domino theory. Domino theory was always, you know, once we lose Vietnam, just all of Asia is going to fall like dominoes, because there's going to be a top-down intelligence kind of orchestrating this kind of thing. In fact, what happened in 1989 to 1991 was that there was a great domino theory of what happens after imperial withdrawal, and both by the Soviet Union, literally in terms of getting out of the Warsaw Pact countries and other places, but both the Soviet Union and the United States withdrew from proxy wars and proxy kind of like we're on this team and not that team all throughout Africa and Central America. And that little brief period of time, 3, 4, 5 years, was one of the biggest outbreaks of peace that have ever happened. It was kind of a domino theory, but in each case, it was what happens when the big guys stop trying to fix it. The people on the ground then own, as Nick was saying, own their own sense of freedom, which is much more powerful and lasting than anything that can be imposed from the outside looking in. Just to keep it on foreign policy briefly, at least, and kind of the U.S. Version of all of this, over the weekend, also, we've had a couple of cases of the presidents of the United States talking about both nuclear aspirants, North Korea, and nukes having Pakistan. The North Korean leader said that he's got a big red button on his desk now, and so you better watch out. To which President Trump said sanctions and other pressures are beginning to have a big impact on North Korea. Perhaps that is good news, perhaps not. We will see. And he used the phrase rocket man. And then on Pakistan, which is probably the most unstable country that currently has nuclear weapons, the president, I think today, tweeted out, and we're recording this on Tuesday morning, the United States has foolishly given Pakistan more than $33 billion in aid over the last 15 years, and they have given us nothing but lies and deceit, thinking of our leaders as fools. They give safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan with little help, no more. Catherine, just kind of start a perhaps brief kind of meta conversation. The thing that Pakistan and North Korea have in common is more or less nuclear weapons. We treat them somewhat differently because of nuclear weapons. And, you know, if we have a conflict with North Korea, which I hope we don't, and we'll see, it will be because of nuclear weapons. Do we have a problem? Do we think too much about nuclear proliferation, and therefore that leads us into blundering situations? Or is this mess kind of working in its own weird way so that there's only 10 or so nuclear armed countries in the world?
We probably think both too little and in the wrong ways about nuclear proliferation, right? So we have this very Cold War state of mind that still permeates everything in our foreign policy, but especially this question. And we still have this idea that we can sort of remind everyone that we have nukes too, so please don't kill us. And that's kind of, I mean, I know that there are many, many people who have thought very deeply about this, and many of them are powerful and have spent billions of dollars implementing their theories. And yet, at least to an outsider, and to a person who just read Reason Magazine's pretty great interview with Daniel Ellsberg about this question, check it out in the current issue, that it seems like we are still kind of stuck in just a very, very simplistic deterrent mindset. This idea that somehow the billions that we have spent on foreign aid to Pakistan is central to the question seems extremely weird to me. And it's part of the extremely weird conversation we have about foreign aid everywhere all the time in our politics, that somehow that is both a budgetarily relevant thing and also a geopolitically relevant thing, when in fact it is more or less neither, and certainly far, far less relevant than just the sheer ability to obliterate each other, which the U.S. and North Korea, or the North Korea would like to have, maybe has claims to have, is going to use any minute now, and which Pakistan definitely has.
Nick, when you hear the phrase foreign aid by anyone in a political point, do you roll your eyes or do you nod in vigorous agreement in terms of we should just stop giving it and that's the first step towards anything?
Well, I mean, I think trade is obviously always preferable to aid, and opening up both, economic and cultural and, immigration exchange, that's always better. Pakistan is a really interesting question, because if you talk to people, and last week for the Reason podcast, I interviewed Rafia Zakaria, who is Pakistani-American or Pakistani-born, lives in America, and wrote a great book called Veil about how, Islamic head coverings for women really are devoid of any specific meaning and get played out in different ways. But she was talking about how Pakistan has gone so far backwards, and it is in the grip of a religious fervor, of a fundamentalism. I mean, it was a generally modern country up through a certain point into the 80s, and then in the 90s, it would be as if the religious right had really actually taken over in America and locked down all sorts of stuff. I think our foreign aid, which was there because we know that it's a hotbed of terrorism, and, that's where Osama bin Laden ran into. We know all of that. It is an ungoverned country, as you were saying, Matt. It's very unstable. The government doesn't even control, all much of the territory that it supposedly rules. The foreign aid is not helping that government do a better job or be a better government or really take territory back from Islamists. So I don't know. Aid is not the answer in these kinds of circumstances. It seems pretty clear. And in that sense, you got to give Trump credit. He's calling a spade a spade.
Peter, besides Nick's racism, this discussion calls to mind. There's a lot of people out there who are kind of rediscovering, bad 1980s nuclear Holocaust movies and things like that, and saying it's time to get scared all over again. When Trump uses the phrase rocket man, we should all be trembling. Are you terrified anew, since you're too young to remember the Cold War, that we're all going
to
get blown up?
Or remember both Testament and Matt. Do you remember watching The Day After?
Day After. I don't remember Testament at all, but it's all about The Day After. And more importantly, it's about Red Dawn, if we're being honest about it, because we win.
Yeah, sure.
Or we lose gloriously with Patrick Swayze.
Wolverines. Go Wolverines.
So, Peter, since you're a movie reviewer, are we at least going to get some really bad Kris Kristofferson movies out of this?
I'm old enough to have re-experienced Cold War terror as an adult through The Americans and by watching the show The Americans. And so I'm
pretty sure we just uncovered why American foreign policy is fucked up right now.
Yep.
So I'm reliving it. No, I was afraid of nuclear terror as a 5-year-old. I was just slightly too old for like the duck and cover drills and the, tuck your blue jeans into your socks.
What are you talking about? Those ended in the 50s,
too young.
Didn't they?
Too young.
Sorry, slightly too young.
I mean, I don't know.
Whichever age, sometimes I feel really old and then sometimes I talk to you guys.
Thank you, Sonny.
2018, starting strong.
Look, I think we should maintain a healthy fear of nuclear exchanges anywhere in the world, because a nuclear exchange means almost certainly at very best, tens of thousands of people dead and quite possibly hundreds of thousands.
You're talking in bumper stickers. Now, one nuclear bomb could ruin your whole day. Next, you're going to be telling us you can't hug your kids with nuclear arms?
As much as I really like playing Fallout 3.
You can't win the human race.
So, it's 2018, which means that recreational marijuana is now legal in California, which is kind of an amazing moment that we're seeing here. Nick, I want to start with you, since, as Peter has pointed out, you're old. And put in kind of perspective of us, you've been writing against the drug war for as long as you've had fingers. What does this mean? What does this kind of represent in the long struggle?
Yeah, I mean, it is stunning. I mean, and you know, we should not forget that it's also Nevada this year, and then Massachusetts is going to start selling recreational pot legally in the middle of the year as well. So it's more than that. You know, when I joined Reason in 93, one of the first big pieces I wrote in 96 was about medical marijuana passing in Arizona and California by ballot initiative. And even then, like, you know, you kind of knew that the war on pot was going to end in our lifetime. But it's, you know, it's kind of like the Berlin Wall collapsing or the Soviet Union. You know, it can't go on forever, but it's stunning as it's unfolding. And I think, you know, what we are going to see now is a radical change in America, where pot is going to be legalized everywhere within a few years. It is not a small thing. Like, it's not simply, okay, well, it's like, at, you know, it's like the market for, you know, small batch rye whiskey now or something like that. It is fundamentally different because the war on drugs is a structuring element of everything that we do, whether it's foreign policy, law enforcement, education policy, medical thinking and whatnot. This is a string that when you start to pull on it and unravel it, it's going to go through every aspect of American life. And I think what it's going to do, the really salutary effect that it's going to have, is that it's going to reframe the way we think about drugs. And instead of thinking about drugs as good and bad in absolute terms, which is how we've been doing it for over 100 years, we're going to start thinking about, okay, what are the benefits of drugs in helping us live and think and breathe and, you know, just get on with our lives the way we want to? And what are the negative effects? Because we've already been doing that. And I actually think the shift to a pharmaceutical society, really, which has happened over the past 30 or 40 years, Ron Bailey has written about this, that the major breakthroughs and changes in people's life expectancy as well as quality of life is really because drugs have become widespread, more effective and better. And I think this is kind of a lagging indicator of that. Long way of saying, at the same time, there's so much, like, I'm as worried as anything about the kind of all quiet on the Western Front. Like, who are the people who are going to be killed now that the armistice has been declared? There's still a lot of fighting going on just about pot, much less other more kind of controversial drugs. And my heart goes out for the people who are about to be processed and put into prison for pot-related or other nonviolent drug crimes, because we still have a lot of, you know, there's the piece to win here, which we haven't even begun.
Catherine,
to do.
My main triumph as editor of the magazine was that a cover we ran of a Kentucky Fried Chicken that had been converted into a medical marijuana dispensary in California then found its way as kind of in a South Park episode. I think that was even titled Medical Marijuana Fried Chicken, in which they portrayed a California where weed was legal, but fast food was illegal, and it created a huge black market and like gangs to sell fast food illicitly to the children's and everything, which is a long way of saying not just how great I and Reason are, but like how California and blue states, the exact places where you might see this stuff become legalized, are some of the worst when it comes to basic regulatory freedom and taxing it. They could screw it up. So how worried are you that they are going to screw it up? Are they going to learn the lessons of the kind of the worst of the legalizations that have happened so far?
This is the future liberals want, man. They want a world where there's legal weed and illegal fried chicken. I think there's a super high risk that they're going to screw it up. And I was actually just reading this morning, they have already screwed up one key provision, which is everybody keeps saying, oh, they're regulating weed just like they regulate alcohol. But at least in one respect, that's not true. They're school zones. There are school zone rules, and those are quite extensive. It's 1,000 feet from any school, daycare center, place where a child might have once been, place where a child might once someday be. That will increase penalties. It converts a legal substance essentially back into a illegal substance. And that's going to be incredibly onerous because you don't always know you're in one of those zones. And as we have reported in an article in this week's or this month's magazine as well, you know, law enforcement uses these school zones to amp up penalties, to make people take pleas. They're incredibly poisonous in a way that is really undercovered and underappreciated in our prohibition regime. And that's not going away with weed in California. And there will be people who were worried about this in the first place, who will look to expand those rules. So, yes, in addition to the stupid, you know, you can't satisfy your munchies because saturated fat is illegal. Is that the bad one? Unsaturated fat? Whichever one's the bad one, that one's illegal. Trans fat. That one's definitely illegal in California.
No, you're not allowed to attack
that's
trans
true.
Fat anymore.
Trans fat is so brave. And
I love trans fat brunch.
There's definitely also going to be Baptist and bootleggers problem with these school zones and a bunch of other similar regs.
Suderman, Nick name checked Rye Whiskey, and you wrote a great piece for the magazine about kind of the lingering effects of prohibition had on nearly killing the cocktail there. In your studies of post-alcohol prohibition, are there lessons that can be learned about post-marijuana prohibition that we should keep in mind as we begin the end of finally unstructuring this terrible regime that has structured too much of America badly?
Yes, definitely. The end of prohibition was, of course, a good thing because the federal government said that it is no longer illegal to sell and produce alcohol. On the other hand, what the end of prohibition did basically was turn alcohol regulation over to the states and to local governments. So, like I said, it was certainly an improvement over the status quo, but at the same time, it left an awful lot of basically alcohol prohibition in place. And prohibition era thinking in place in many states. And so prohibition didn't just sort of it didn't just end overnight. It took decades and decades and decades. And we are still there are still places where parts of the kind of prohibition thinking still make it difficult to buy alcohol or certain types of alcohol in certain ways. You can think of all sorts of interstate shipping sorts of things. You can think of the three-tier system, which basically requires a middleman before you end up purchasing. You can think of state sales of alcohol, where states control all of the sales themselves, often as a sort of revenue generation scheme. And so I think that we will likely see a lot of similar sorts of policies put in place as pot is legalized nationwide, which is what I think is going to happen now. The the other thing, though, that I would say that's specific to California is that California's regulatory regime is going to, and how it ends up implementing this is going to end up having a huge amount of influence, just because it's California, and California in its own way is like a country. And I think people who kind of live on the East Coast and sort of are over here in Acela land and haven't maybe spent much time in California sometimes forget this or underweight it. But California is like its own. It's like its own country in some ways, that is just kind of housed within the larger United States in a way that other states in the in the U.S. aren't. And so because of that, it is going to exert a kind of dominant, heavy influence on kind of setting up, paving the way for legalization elsewhere, but also for how it is regulated and sold and how people are allowed to access it.
I want to push back on the California exceptionalism, partly because I lived there for a few years and I know
that wasn't exceptionalism.
Matt. No, but you're saying that California is uniquely positioned to influence the way things happen in the rest of the country. And when you think about a lot of culinary And kind of even, you know, wine, California changed the American wine industry and the global wine industry. But that was a long time ago. And when you think of things like the microbrew revolution and even kind of the gastropub phenomenon, it's been a while since California has been anything other than a kind of cautionary tale, which might be part of what you're talking about. But I think when you look at the head start that Colorado has, which Colorado had a successful medical marijuana industry that it taxed and regulated. It is the by far and away the most successful state to legalize recreational pot. And it's still working through a lot of problems, but it has done everything right in terms of finding a sweet spot between taxes that generate meaningful revenue but don't maintain a black market, et cetera. I think Colorado is actually going to be more of the model, even that California takes. And you already see within California, San Diego has done a good job, LA, not so good. And it's you know, in terms of dealing with the idea of legal pot. I think California is big because it's the most populous state. But after that, I think its influence is going to be less than you might imagine.
Yeah, there are actually no dispensaries in Los Angeles as of today, which is really sort of it's kind of interesting, right?
It's a reason why LA, you know, LA should be, you know, by far and away, it should be the leader in everything in America, you know, and it isn't because it has really crappy municipal government, even worse. And it doesn't have the density of people and the international reputation that New York has too. It's a shame.
I think it's indisputable that the modern era of legalizing recreational pot
started in California
by the failure of Proposition 19, but that failure, which was engineered by a medical marijuana dispensary owner who wanted to legalize things, it kind of woke up the infrastructure of the drug advocacy groups to say, okay, well, let's keep doing medical, but let's go for the big prize from now on. And Colorado, as Nick rightly points out, kind of led the way there. I think in one way that California is just by its size interesting is kind of similar to airline deregulation, where California and Texas were able to incubate companies like Southwest just because it's so big. California is so big physically, geographically, that they're going to be able to grow a whole lot of weed over in near Arcadia.
That's also, you know, bringing up Texas is also a good point that, you know, the first big red state to legalize pot, that you know, it's coming, and it's been sped up by California, no doubt. But I think, you know, when the first like true red state legalizes recreational pot, that's, you know, when the, you know, that's raising the flag at Iwo Jima.
Let's round third, head to home here. And talk just very briefly about some stories that you all are looking at that we didn't maybe talk about this week. Nick, do you want to go first? What's interesting you out there?
What's interesting me this week is actually all sorts of IP stuff. Every year there's a group of people at Duke that talk about what works would have gone into the public domain if copyright laws were less dictated by major corporations, entertainment companies, along the lines of Disney and what have you. And it's fascinating to think about all of the stuff that would be freely available without copyright hassle. I like thinking about that because, you know, our culture, all cultures are remix cultures, and anything we can do to make it easier to ravage the past and kind of manipulate it for whatever we want. You know, and it's the same thing like, you know, going to a thrift store and finding some old, you know, fashion and then remaking it for the modern era. It's exactly the same way with cultural appropriation and cultural expression. And this group always releases a list, you know, on New Year's. And that's what I'm thinking about right now.
Catherine?
The thing that I am thinking about right now is the fact that Donald Trump just tweeted that DACA activists and Hispanics will go hard against Dems, will start, quote, falling in love with Republicans and their president. So if that's what 2018 has for us, I guess I'm happy to see some love. Seems pretty unlikely. No, I mean the DACA stuff, I think, is going to flare back up. I think it's such an interesting test case because these are immigrants who are the perfect immigrants. And I know that, you know, model minorities and all that is hashtag problematic, but these are people who were by and large raised in the United States, who have completed their educations or are completing their educations. They are already assimilated. They already have roots here. If we can't agree to let the Dreamers and DACA folks stay, I really don't think that Republicans have any legitimate claim to say that they are pro-immigration and to try and split the hair between legal and illegal. They just don't like immigrants if they don't like these.
And it's Congress.
But I guess I'm happy if there's going to be some falling in love.
It's worth pointing out that the president, or Donald Trump, has gone from on the campaign trail saying we need to deport legal U.S. citizens who are children of illegal immigrants to now, in his own blustery way, saying that he wants to sign a DACA deal with Democrats. So that's some kind of interesting progress. Suderman, what hast thou?
Well, speaking of Twitter, I just spent a week not on it, and it was glorious. I have been thinking that 2018 is going to be a year of kind of social media reckoning, and we are going to start thinking probably in some stupid ways, but hopefully in some productive ways, about the larger social effects on both culture and politics of social media, and how it's how it is sort of changing the world in ways that we don't recognize. And there will be all sorts of interesting flashpoints, everything from Donald Trump's nuclear bomb setting off tweets to things like the YouTube star Logan Paul, who is one of these guys who you probably haven't heard of if you're listening to this.
If you have kids, you've heard of him.
Oh, well, OK. So then possibly you've heard of him. And he apparently filmed a suicide and uploaded it to his YouTube or a dead body that had committed suicide, uploaded it to his YouTube channel, has already apologized. And so these sorts of things, I think, are going to become more a part of our kind of modern discussion about what it means to live on and offline. And probably there's going to be some dumb laws that pop up as a result of that.
And just building off that a little bit, my choice of what I'm paying attention to, which speaks more about me than anything else, probably is the Baseball Hall of Fame is going to announce its new inductees at the end of this month. And the process, the voting process, all the ballots are now in, has been very interesting to watch because it's been materially affected by transparency, by people on the outside asking writers to see the Baseball Writers Association to see their ballots. And especially this one guy on Twitter, he's not Mr. Tibbs, because why not? He updates constantly. So writers have been able to see how their votes, and they have a limited number of them, can actually impact the election and have adjusted their votes accordingly, which I think has all kinds of interesting possible ramifications as we think about why Catherine Mangu Ward is going to vote again next year.
Matt, who is your who is the kind of unicorn that you want to see in the Hall of Fame this time around?
Well, Edgar Martinez is the one who has he's on the bubble and he's almost out of time. So he's the cause celeb. But then Larry Walker, who is getting this surprising last minute gust of support because of these outsiders going in. So if Larry Walker could get in next time, that would be awesome. Scott Rowland, too, deserves more credit than he's getting. But that's all the credit getting that we have time for now on the Reason podcast. Thank you all for listening. Please do subscribe to us over there on iTunes. Rate and review us while you're there. And we shall see you next week with this grouping and throughout the week with other Reason podcast fare. Thank you.